It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. A coalition of Syrian rebel fighters led by Al-Qaeda branch took over the last government-held city in northwestern Idlib province bordering Turkey. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says Syrian forces pulled out of Ariya Thursday after bitter fighting with the Al-Fatah army. The number of casualties is unclear. Al-Fatah is a rebel coalition led by the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Nusra Front. Iraqi security officials say two car bombs exploded at 2 5-star hotels in Baghdad, killing at least 10 people. The first explosion occurred in the parking lot of the Babylon Hotel late Thursday, killing 6, wounding 14 others. Moments later, another car bomb struck outside a former Sheraton hotel, killing 4 people, wounding 13. There has been no claim of responsibility. Libyan tribal leaders wrapped up a 4-day meeting Thursday in Cairo by announcing the creation of a unified council to help find a solution to their strife-torn country. Since longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi was toppled and killed in 2011, battle-hardened rebel groups armed with heavy weapons have been carving out their own regions inside of Libya. Burundi's Catholic Church says it is withdrawing its support of the country's upcoming elections after weeks of political unrest. Burundi's Catholic bishops say it's asking its clergy, who serve on electoral commissions, to step down from those commissions. President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to seek a re-election for a third term sparked weeks of often violent protest in which more than 20 people have died in clashes between protesters and police. This is VOA News. UN Security Council will meet later today to discuss the threat of foreign terrorist fighters, both to the conflict zones where they fight and to their home countries when they return. UN correspondent Margaret Bashir reports.
The United Nations estimates that there are between 15 and 20,000 foreign terrorist fighters, or FTFs, maybe even 30,000. The fighters are as young as 14 years old and include women. They come from virtually every corner of the world. The Security Council will assess progress in September, when President Barack Obama presided over the adoption of a resolution intended to halt the flow of FTFs. The resolution called for the implementation of several measures, including the screening of airline passenger lists, disrupting funding to armed groups, and improving the sharing of relevant information among states to stop terrorists from recruiting, planning, or participating in attacks. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter says that defense officials are looking at ways to enhance efforts to train and equip pro-government forces in Iraq as they battle Islamic State fighters. While on a trip to Asia, Secretary Carter said recent events in Iraq, where the militants seized the provincial capital of the sprawling Anbar province west of Baghdad, have shown the need for a capable ground partner. U.S. has been conducting airstrikes in Iraq since August, but so far ruled out sending any ground troops of its own. Human rights groups say they have begun a surge of executions in Saudi Arabia. The country carried out its 89th prisoner execution this week, roughly the total number killed in all of 2014. Human Rights Watch Middle East researcher Adam Kugel says officials are giving no reason for the increase.
Because the Saudi Arabian authorities do not comment publicly on this issue other than to say that under Islamic law it's their right to carry out executions. Because they don't release information, we really don't know for sure why there's been such a rise in the number of those executions over the last, really, 8 to 9 months.
The rise in executions began last August after Islamic State militants attacked cities and towns in Iraq and Syria. United States says the thousands of migrants adrift in Southeast Asian waters need urgent rescue. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Ann Richard told reporters in Bangkok today, "We have to save lives urgently." Richard is in Thailand to attend a one-day meeting of Southeast Asian countries and rights groups that convened today as part of a concerted effort to address the boat people problem in the Andaman Sea and the Bay of Bengal. Get more news at our website, voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 29th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's President-elect Muhammadu Buhari will be inaugurated today, Friday.
The mood of the country will change. There will be a Buhari environment coming into place for May 29th. And this is about zero tolerance of corruption. Because of the fact that Buhari is in office, he's ready to lead by example.
Shehu Garba is the spokesman for Nigeria's President-elect Muhammadu Buhari. The UN says millions suffer from dramatic escalation of conflicts in Africa's Sahel region. A deputy U.S. Assistant Secretary of State will comment on her recent visit to Zimbabwe, and Burundi's powerful Roman Catholic Church withdraw its members from the country's Electoral Commission.
This means that it's a very, very serious crisis in the Independent Electoral Commission, because the Catholic Church, that is the most important religion in Burundi. Let's say more or less 85% of the people here are Catholics.
Innocent Muhozi is the general manager of the independent Renaissance radio station of Burundi. An Angolan journalist found guilty yesterday for criminal libel says he will stay in the country to help bring about change. And South Africa's sports minister denies his country paid bribe to win the 2010 FIFA World Cup. Those stories, plus Marco Oman's pulse and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's President-elect General Muhammadu Buhari is being inaugurated today, Friday, in the capital, Abuja. A survey by Afrobarometer this week lists unemployment, reliable supply of electricity, crime, insecurity, and corruption as the top concerns for most Nigerians that they would like for Mr. Buhari to address. Spokesman Shehu Garba says Mr. Buhari is fully prepared to take on the challenges. Garba says Mr. Buhari will keep his promise to bolster security and jumpstart Nigeria's economy to create job opportunities, particularly for the country's youth.
From day one, he will be ready. I mean, there is no question about this. He has run on an election promise to combat terrorism and ensure security in the country, you know, tackle the economy, which everyone knows is in trouble, and able to create jobs, to also deal with the issue of corruption. And there's a party program, and he's ready to roll out all of these things from day one. Of course, the expectations are enormous, and perhaps Nigerians, given the suffering that we are going through, might make assumptions and solutions being there for everything on day one. That is not going to happen, because unless Buhari becomes a magician.
How are Nigerians reacting to having a new president? Of course, after they voted for him in the recent presidential or general election.
There's excitement. You can, as the air is as thick as you can feel and you can touch it. Now, this change came about because the country had been mismanaged. The outcome of the election results is a clear indication that they wanted something new. They wanted something fresh. So therefore, yes, that's why they voted massively for Muhammadu Buhari. So the expectations are high. Everyone wants to be, we don't want the unwanted situation going on in the country, whether it's the issue of the corruption, which has reached an industrial scale, unemployment, which is about 60% of employable graduates. You know, all of these things are there. And Nigerians are saying, look, let's just have something different. And that's where we are.
What should Nigerians expect after day one, as you put it?
Well, nobody should expect something of an earthquake in terms of policy and all of that. There will be substantial continuity on a number of areas. However, the mood of the country will change. There will be a Buhari environment coming into place from May 29. And this is about the zero tolerance for corruption. Our expectation is that routine corruption in day-to-day matters of public service and all of that, 50% will disappear because of the fact that Buhari is in office. They will just stop it. He's ready to lead by example. He's going to be a law abider. For the first time, he has a Nigerian leader who is saying, I want to follow the rule of law. He has given instructions. He stops at the traffic junction. When he's flagged on, then he moves on. He observes all traffic regulations. This hasn't been seen in all of the years of democracy in this country. And that is the kind of thing that he will lead by personal example.
Shehu Garba is the spokesman for Nigeria's president-elect Muhammadu Buhari, who is being inaugurated today, Friday. He was speaking with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. The United Nations says a dramatic escalation in the conflicts raging in Africa's Sahel region has increased suffering for millions of people, many of whom were already living under difficult circumstances. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations says providing emergency humanitarian aid to millions of people in the Sahel has become more complex and dangerous. It says problems of acute child malnutrition and food insecurity, of disease epidemics and natural disasters can no longer be tackled within a specific country alone. It says they have become regional problems and arise from the death, displacement and destruction of property caused by conflict. The UN Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Sahel, Robert Piper, says in just 1 year, the number of people displaced inside and outside their countries in the region has jumped from 1.6 million to 3.5 million. He says they seek refuge in communities that are themselves extremely vulnerable.
Southern Niger, the Difa region, already has over half of its population food insecure, and it has now received a doubling of its population from displaced people from Nigeria. Tremendous pressure on food, on water. Many of these people move with animals as well, so there's this very dangerous dynamic of displacement into acute vulnerability.
Piper says other problem areas include Mali, where violence appears to be getting worse despite peace negotiations, Sudan's Darfur region, where renewed violence is pushing people into Chad, and the Central African Republic, where 2+ years of conflict shows no sign of coming to an end. One of the worst ongoing conflicts is in northeast Nigeria, where the Boko Haram insurgency has displaced 1.3 million people. UN Deputy Humanitarian Coordinator in Nigeria, Munir Safieldin, says many women and girls have been abducted and forced into sexual slavery. He says it is believed nearly 1,000 women have been rescued from Boko Haram, but he warns they face a difficult reality.
Some of these girls have been reported to be pregnant, and definitely these are unwanted pregnancies, a result of rape. And some of them, I believe, have been reported to have tested HIV positive. Definitely we will need to scale up very soon the level of psychosocial counseling for them. But some of the challenges now are related to what are the options for them to reintegrate into society. Will they ever be able to pick up their life, get married, have their own children and their own life?
The UN officials are pinning hopes on things getting better under incoming President Muhammadu Buhari, who has pledged a stronger military commitment to defeating Boko Haram. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Burundi's powerful Roman Catholic Church says it is withdrawing its support of the country's upcoming election. In a statement Thursday, the country's Catholic bishop said they have asked their clergy who serve on electoral commissions to step down from those commissions. Also on Thursday, the European Union announced it was suspending its election observer mission in Burundi. An EU statement said the election process has been marred by restrictions on independent media, excessive use of force against demonstrators, and a climate of intimidation for opposition parties and civil society. Innocent Muhozi, general manager of the independent Renaissance radio station, said the church's decision creates a serious problem for the Electoral Commission because the Catholic Church is the most important religion in Burundi.
The Catholic Church now will not stay in this commission. They left the commission. This means that it's a very, very serious crisis in the Independent Electoral Commission because some of the members are not any longer in it. Everybody now understands here and see that it's a serious problem to hear that the Catholic Church, that is the most important religion in Burundi, let's say more or less 85% of the people here are Catholic. So it's a very, very, very big issue now.
Quite interesting. I'm reading that there were some Catholic priests who were serving on the Elections Commission. Is that true?
Yes, that's it. That's it. There is always members of the Catholic Church who are in the commissions. In it, traditionally, it's always like that.
So now, what did the government say? I mean, the Electoral Commission of Burundi, is it still a goal to have the election?
The spokesman of this commission said that this is not a very big issue because the places are going to be taken by some other people, that this is not a problem, but it's a problem. We all know that it's a big problem. And it's not only the Catholic Church that decided to leave, because the observers from the European Union today say they cannot continue because the conditions for fair and transparent elections are not there to allow elections in Burundi. So they say they are leaving also, those observers from the European Union.
President Pierre Nkurunziza and the Electoral Commission of Burundi, can they ignore the statement by the Catholic Church?
It seems like it's the choice they made till now. It seems like they are saying that this is not something that is serious. They can still have the elections with no members from the Catholic Church. They can still have elections with no financial support from the international community. They still can have elections with international observers. They still can set. Till now, they're saying that all these things can not stop them from going to elections.
President Nkurunziza had asked patriotic Burundians to donate towards the election. How is that doing?
They are not going to be voluntary contributions. I think maybe they can take some money from the salaries of states. This is still possible. But if you ask people to give their own money, no one is going to give money because people don't have no money at all. You know, today, $1 is more than 2,000 Burundian francs. 10 years ago, $1 was less than 1,000 Burundian francs. We see what does it mean, this? Burundians are in a serious financial situation. It's very tough for everyone here today.
Innocent Muhozi is the general manager of the Independent Renaissance Radio and Television Network in Burundi. You're speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 29th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. Deputy U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Shannon Smith says the U.S. is sticking to its wait-and-see strategy as far as changing policy or lifting sanctions on Zimbabwe. Smith had just returned from a short visit to Zimbabwe earlier this month. She tells Blessing Zulu of Viewers Zimbabwe Service that targeted sanctions on Zimbabwe are not the cause of the country's economic decline.
Well, the U.S. sanctions are aimed at fewer than 200 individuals and institutions in Zimbabwe, in a nation of over 13 million people. They are very targeted. Zimbabwe economy is absolutely struggling. That was a clear message that we heard from people on our visit there. But for explanations, I would point to the World Bank's Ease of Doing Business report, where Zimbabwe is in the bottom 20 countries in the world in terms of ease of countries being able to make investments and do business and operate.
But recently we have seen that the European Union is engaging the Zimbabwe government. That is in contrast to the position that Washington has taken. Don't you feel pressured to at least use that model?
We don't feel pressured. The European Union obviously makes its own policy choices, but I think we continue to share with them the same fundamental goals of seeing a freer, democratic Zimbabwe that adheres to the rule of law and other standards.
Let's talk about the human rights situation. What did you observe?
We met extensively with people in and out of government to talk about the human rights situation. In particular, we raised the disappearance of Mr. Itai Zamara, who has been missing for over 2 months and whose continuing disappearance is a subject of great concern to people there and here in Washington.
Do you think, from what you are hearing, that the government is doing enough to find Mr. Zamara?
I think the United States believes they should certainly do more. We made that point as strongly as we could.
Talking about the civil society in Zimbabwe, what is your take?
We always have been engaging with civil society. And I think one of the things that always impresses me there is the vibrancy of civil society in Zimbabwe, of the youth groups that we met with, of women's groups and others who are, you know, dedicated to creating a better situation for themselves, for their communities, for their country.
Shannon Smith is Deputy U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She was speaking with Blessing Zulu of Viewers Zimbabwe Service in Washington. Angolan journalist and anti-corruption activist Rafael Marques de Moraes says he will stay in the country to help bring about change. He says if anyone is to be forced to leave the country, it should be what he called the corrupt and totalitarian individuals who are destroying the country. De Moraes was found guilty yesterday for criminal libel, having exposed human rights abuses in the diamond-producing northeast province of the country. The case was brought by seven generals and the Minister of State and head of presidential security. He says the judge convicted him for publishing a book detailing hundreds of cases of torture and killing allegedly carried out in two diamond-producing districts.
The judge, based on two facts, convicted me to 6 months imprisonment and suspended the sentence for 2 years. So basically putting me on a 2-year probation. If I don't behave well, then I go to jail. And what are those two facts the judge used to convict me? That I published a book in Portugal and that I lodged a criminal complaint here based on the book for the Angolan authorities to investigate the atrocities I reported in my book.
Did they deny any of the allegations? Did they prove anything?
They didn't prove anything. There was no discussion of the fact or of the cases I reported in my book. Also because on the 21st of May, I offered some explanations to the court which led the generals to withdraw the charges and also the public prosecutor to agree with that statement and then also to drop the need for evidence to be heard and for the witnesses to be heard.
When we spoke with you yesterday, you mentioned that the generals and the prosecutor had asked you to make a patriotic statement. Do you think you should have made that statement? And do you blame yourself because of what happened now?
No, I don't blame myself because this is a process in which I demonstrated a sense of honesty and integrity. And also because what I said in court, it's true that I presented my diligence to the managers of the companies owned by the generals and not directly by the generals. Of course, it's like you working for Voice of America. When you want to contact a government official, you contact that office. If they don't pass the information above, it is not your fault.
Rafael, so what are the conditions for your suspended sentence? Are you allowed to practice as a journalist or what?
The condition is so preposterous because now the judge says that I have an agreement with the generals. Where is that agreement? The book was published in Portugal. What jurisdiction does he have over Portugal?
Quite interesting. Quite interesting. So what are you going to do? Do you intend to stay in Luanda, in Angola, or what are your plans?
Of course I intend to stay. These individuals are wrecking this country. The bad ones are the ones who must leave, not me. Why do people with integrity are always asked to leave? So the devilish ones, the corrupt, the authoritarians, the incompetent, stay in place and stay in power and do whatever they want. We must change that mindset.
That was Angolan journalist and anti-corruption activist Rafael Marques de Moraes. He was speaking with me from the capital, Luanda. South Africa is reeling in the wake of a U.S. indictment that says officials bribed the World Football Organization, FIFA, to secure the 2010 World Cup. The country's postmaster is denying it made any payments. VOA's Anita Powell has more from Johannesburg.
That was the sound of South Africa's 2010 World Cup, the insistent buzz of the now famous Vuvuzela. But South African officials have made little noise at all in response to the U.S. indictment that asserts, among other things, that South Africa bribed FIFA officials to host that historic tournament. The charges by U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch led to the arrest Wednesday of 14 FIFA officials and executives who are accused of collectively taking more than $150 million in bribes. Lynch's 164-page indictment outlines a scenario in which former FIFA Vice President Jack Warner sent an intermediary to Paris to collect a briefcase stuffed with dollars from a South African official. The indictment does not single out any South African by name. When contacted by VOA seeking comment on the indictment, South African presidential spokesman Harold Moloka passed the ball to the sports ministry. Sports Minister Fikile Mbalula says, according to official records, no such payment came from the ministry or the government.
Our financial records and books for the 2010 and 11 financial years and those before and after the period of the World Cup have been audited by the Auditor General of South Africa, and no such amount has been found on our books.
South Africa's top opposition party has already turned the scandal into a political football. The Democratic Alliance's shadow minister of sports is Soli Malatsi, who is quick to criticize the man who is widely thought to be at the center of these sideline deals, Danny Jordan, the head of the local organizing committee for the 2010 World Cup.
These doxing allegations, you know, they are serious allegations which should be probed. You know, they cannot be swept under the carpet. So what we will be doing as the official opposition is that today we have written a letter to the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Sport and Recreation asking her to immediately summon SAFA under the leadership of Dr. Denis Jordan to the Portfolio Committee to provide an explanation on these allegations.
He said the party believes a bribe to FIFA could not have been paid without the knowledge of senior officials on South Africa's bid committee. Jordan was recently named executive mayor of the Nelson Mandela Bay metropolitan area by the ruling African National Congress. He was due to be endorsed Thursday. Calls to the mayor's office went unanswered. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Namibia edged Madagascar 3-2 as Mozambique pipped Botswana 2-1 in the semifinals at the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup at the Moruleng Stadium, Northwest Province in South Africa on Thursday. Today, Friday, outgoing champions Zambia seek to salvage a measure of national pride when they play Malawi in the plate final at the Royal Bafokeng Sports Palace in Pokeng. The plate contest features teams eliminated in the quarterfinals. Tomorrow, Saturday, at the Moruleng Stadium, Botswana and Madagascar clash in the bronze medal playoff before Namibia and Mozambique battle in the tournament final. In New Zealand, Ghana play Austria at the start of their campaign at the FIFA Under-20 World Cup in Wellington tomorrow Saturday. On Sunday, Mali engage Mexico in Dunedin. In New Zealand, Ghana play Austria at the start of their campaign at the FIFA Under-20 World Cup in Wellington tomorrow Saturday. On Sunday, Mali engage Mexico in Dunedin, while tournament debutant Senegal challenged Portugal in Hamilton. In Olympic news, South Africa hosts Gabon in women's 2016 Olympic football qualifiers in Soweto tomorrow, Saturday. Ghana welcome Egypt. Kenya play Botswana. Equatorial Guinea encounter Republic of Congo. Cameroon face Guinea-Bissau and Zimbabwe host Zambia. Elsewhere, Swaziland is at home to Zimbabwe in men's 2016 Olympic football qualifiers tomorrow, Saturday. Mali play Mauritania. Sudan host Tunisia. Uganda play Rwanda, Cameroon engage Sierra Leone, and Zambia face Botswana. Finally, in boxing, Ghana's former IBF bantamweight champion Joseph King Kong Agbeko fights Juanito Rubila of the Philippines in El Paso, Texas State, in the United States of America tomorrow, Saturday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We'll see you again on Monday. Here's our listener mail for this Friday morning, May 29th.
As the world witnesses another remarkable transition in Nigeria tomorrow, I urge all patriotic Nigerians to pray for the new president and other political elements for God's wisdom to justify the confidence reposed in them by their electorate. I am Usher John in Bendi, Obanoku, Cross-Rapids, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. That's it for this Friday, May 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you a very good weekend.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcast. Check VOA mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
African music hits.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African music mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.